From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When it comes to rigor, there isn't a publication quite like The New Yorker. The magazine is known for having a painstaking process of fact-checking, and the same can be said for the copy department, which has always had incredibly high standards. Mary Norris has been at The New Yorker for more than 30 years now, and she knows, in the popular imagination, a copy editor is a bit of a witch, rigid and persnickety. But in her new book, she says for the good ones, it's about much more than making sure the grammar works and the spelling is right. A good copy editor knows the writer's voice and understands the context and style. Today in the program, Mary Norris is joining us to talk about her book. Part of this is a memoir with stories from The New Yorker, but as you would expect, she also describes some of the common problems she sees in the way some of us write the English language. Join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Mary Norris is joining us. She's worked in the copy department at The New Yorker magazine for more than 35 years now, has written a book, which includes, of course, her observations about usage and spelling and punctuation. I guess you would expect that. But the book is also really personal at times and irreverent and funny, which you might not expect if you give way to the common image of a copy editor at a magazine with the most rigorous editorial standards in the industry. We'll talk about that image today and some of the many stories from her time at The New Yorker. Mary Norris's book is called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. Mary Norris is joining us today from a studio in New York City. She is one of the copy editors of The New Yorker magazine, as I mentioned, one of the page okayers, as they, I guess they call it. Mary Norris, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Doug.
I wanted to begin by asking, when did you first start thinking about writing a book like this? And what did you figure the book would be like?
Well, I'd always been a writer. I had never thought my subject would be commas. But what happened was that some people at the New Yorker's website asked me one day, they told me that somebody had written something a little bit insulting about New Yorker commas in the New York Times. And they asked me if I would write something in response and defend our commas. So I did that, and it ran on the New Yorker's website. And it turned out a lot of people were interested in commas. I hadn't realized that that would be the case. So that was the seed of the book. And I started writing about other quirks of New Yorker style and about pencils. And yeah. Eventually I got in touch with an agent, and he agreed that it might be a book. But at the time, I thought it would be just a book, you know, a collection of isolated pieces about punctuation and spelling. And it was my editor at W.W. Norton who really wanted to make it into a coherent narrative and put stuff about my life in it, instructive things, and just enough anecdotes from The New Yorker to be instructive.
Yeah. So did you push back on the idea of it being a kind of memoir? Did, you know, they wanted it to be something more personal. Did you wonder about that at first?
I did. I didn't mind writing the autobiographical stuff, but what the trick was to get the balance right.
Yeah.
I tended to go into great detail about New Yorker style, and there's an audience for that. People are deeply interested in New Yorker style, but we had to get the balance right. And then when I finally got it through my head that they wanted more personal stuff from me, then I went overboard on those details, too. So everything had to be rejiggered in the end.
Well, you start in Cleveland, where you're from. Your first job at 15 at a, I guess it was a public pool as a foot checker.
Yes, you don't have those out there?
We don't have foot checkers, I don't think. I don't think anyone does except for Cleveland.
Well, I did get some letters after the book came out. It seems to have been a Great Lakes thing in the public pools back in the 50s and 60s and, I don't know, maybe into the 70s. It was part of the ritual. Before you could go into the pool, you had to walk through a disinfectant bath and then stop at the foot-checking station where we had these stools, these benches, looked something like what a shoe salesman sits on. And everyone who wanted to get into the pool had to put one foot at a time up on this little foot-shaped platform and lean over and spread out her toes. And my job was to not let anyone pass if I had a suspicion that she had athlete's foot.
Right. You know, I really liked the section where you write about, I don't know how you'd describe it, this kind of affection for this thing for dairy. Which I guess is the thing that took you to Vermont, I suppose, at least in some way.
Oh, certainly. It's even the thing that took me to New Jersey.
Yeah.
Some adolescent girls have a thing about horses. I had a thing about cows. They seem gentle and productive and kind of beautiful. And I liked the life they led. And I ended up going to Rutgers in New Jersey because I wanted to go to a school that was out of state, and my father was wary of the cost and wanted to send me to a state university in Ohio. But a friend of mine was leafing through a college catalog, and she said, you should go to Rutgers. They have an excellent dairy program. She knew I was interested in cows, and it was also a state university, so I kind of tricked my father into letting me out of state by getting a lower tuition. While I was at Rutgers, I did take one course in how to judge dairy cattle. It was a little course, and we just looked at pictures of cows. I don't think we met any actual cows. And then I ended up going to Vermont, again, because I did think that Vermont sounded like a beautiful place with more cows than people.
Yeah.
And I got a degree, a master's degree in English there. And I also learned how to milk cows in the university's dairy barn.
What was the, English degree obviously gives us a sense that you were interested in words and books and literature and those kinds of things. But did you conceive of, how did you conceive of your, you know, what your career might be in those early days? Did you think that you wanted to be associated with a world of, you know, a world of words?
Well, I'd always wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
And the idea of going to graduate school, even all through school, I wrote. It was hard in graduate school because at that point, in where I went to school, at the University of Vermont, they weren't really encouraging people to do anything creative. They wanted you to just write thing, you know, the kind of academic papers that I was really terrible at, I have to say. When I was in college, I had a little more leeway, and I would do creative projects and, you know, just stiff the professor with them, and usually I got away with it. I did not get away with that so much in graduate school. So after doing that, I decided a master's degree was as far as I wanted to take it, and because the academic world didn't seem to be that open to what I wanted to write, and I didn't want to write academic prose, I thought the other route to writing was commercial publishing. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I moved down to New York City and looked for a job in publishing.
There's this great little story you tell in the introduction about meeting this woman with a strong New York accent, and she sees that you're reading this book on grammar, and she comes up to you and asks you about this book, and that story sort of seems to have stuck with you because you were delighted by the idea that she was interested in your interest in grammar, and that seems to be a lot about what you want for this book. Is as you say in the introduction, it's kind of for people like her who have an interest, I guess, in grammar.
Well, I was really delighted. I had gone out to park my car you know, in New York, we have this elaborate system of alternate side parking. And I'd been doing this for 5 years or so, switching my car from one side of the street to another a couple of days a week. And I'd grabbed this book. It was called My Grammar and I, or Should That Be Me?
Yeah.
And I was looking at it, you know, I was doing research on the subjunctive mood and sitting in the car reading some examples of the subjunctive. And yes, that lady surprised me. She came up and knocked on my car window and said, "Miss, you studying grammar?" And I rolled down the window and showed her the book. She asked, "Is that a good book?" I said, "It was." It was a book that was put out in the States by Reader's Digest. I subsequently found out it was actually based on a book that was printed earlier in the United Kingdom. So it wasn't really American, but it had been, I think, edited for an American audience. Anyway, by the time I finished showing that woman the book, all the parking spots were taken, and I normally would be so angry because I'd gotten skunked out of a parking spot. But I just drove to a garage I knew and parked there. And while I was driving there, I thought, why am I happy? I didn't get a parking spot. And I realized it was because that woman was interested. And I love that people are interested in grammar and that they would try to find out more about it, that maybe that woman found a book and sat in her car and studied it after that.
Yeah. So how do you describe what you want for the book? I mean, because you do say your fondest hope is that people will learn, this is a reference to the title, will learn to say fearlessly this you know, term between you and me, not between you and I. It's for people who want to feel better about their grammar, I guess.
I do. I think what happens is that people get insecure. Yeah. You know, people think, you know, people are still hearing about how they used to do diagramming of sentences in the old days. I think we spent maybe 2 days diagramming sentences when I was in about third grade. It wasn't that big a deal. I didn't really learn grammar until I studied German. When I was a senior in college, that's when it became clear to me that English worked in some of the same ways that German did. So I wrote the book thinking that I do want people to start using the word me instead of I in those kind of formulations when it's in what is known as the objective case.
Yeah.
It may be, I hope I'm not fighting a completely losing battle because I hear between you and I all the time. Some people have even written to me to compliment me on the book and misquoted the title, Between You and I. So my idea is that you can learn how to say it right simply by putting the pronoun that refers to yourself first, right? You would never say between I and you. You'd say between me and you. I think my idea was that people can know naturally how to do that by ear. You don't have to know the grammar behind it, but it doesn't hurt to know the grammar behind it. And so I've attempted to explain it without reference to, say, Latin grammar, which I don't know.
Right. When did you first start reading The New Yorker?
I was in graduate school. In fact, I'd almost finished graduate school, so it would have been the summer of 1977 or the spring of 1977. And it was a great time to be reading The New Yorker because that's when short stories by Woody Allen were running, the Kugelmass episode.
Yeah. Classic.
And also that wonderful series by John McPhee that became the book Coming Into the Country about Alaska.
Yeah. It was an amazing stretch of work. And in the McPhee story, you say in the book that you encountered the word synecdoche. I always get that wrong, by the way. And in fact, you talk about how it is. You phonetically spell it out, actually, which is kind of helpful. But you really took note of that word. And in fact, you say it made you ecstatic. Explain why.
Well, I'd never seen the word before. Yeah. Synecdoche, synecdoche. I probably pronounced it synecdoche in my own head when I first saw it. But he used it in a way that made its meaning clear. He said their window was synecdoche. It was Alaska. In other words, this single window looking onto a landscape in Alaska was standing in for all of Alaska. It was the whole view of the whole place. And when I looked it up, I found out that, you know, it meant something small writ large or the other way around. Mm-hmm. So as you would say, 20 sail for 20 ships, you would pick out one part of the ship and it would stand for it all. Well, this window stood for an entire view of all of Alaska. And the placement of that word, the choice of that word, I could see that John McPhee had used it on purpose. You know, it's not a word you encounter every day, mm-hmm. but it was the only word for what he wanted to say. And it was like a jewel set in that sentence. And once I looked it up and understood what it meant, you know, that was kind of a life-changing moment. I just wanted to work with people who had that kind of sensitivity to words and that kind of sensibility about words. I wanted to be one of them.
Yeah. It's interesting. One of the things that comes out in the book when you talk about working with people like McPhee, for example, is that your job as a copy editor, or really your job, you know, during the editorial process, is understanding, is not trying to get to some fixed rule, but understanding when you can sort of let go of the rule, understanding, I think it's the writer's voice, is how you put it in the book.
Yes. I know as a writer myself, when I've had things changed that don't sound like me anymore, that it always bothers me. And when a thing would get published with something in it that didn't sound like me, I wouldn't feel fond of that piece at all. I'd kind of disown it. And you don't want to be doing that to a writer, or even putting the writer in the position of having to defend what he's written, although that does happen. And then, of course, you let the writer... It's wonderful when somebody has an articulate response to a query, and then you get to leave it alone. Sometimes it's my job just to make sure that that's what they want to say. But we do try very hard. You know, of course, we want it to be correct, but sometimes, certainly in fiction, you might have a narrator who does not speak proper, perfect English. I think of George Saunders. Mm. His work often has a narrator who is not overeducated, shall we say, and is writing in a bit of a shorthand. And you don't want to interfere with that effect. So, you know, you let things go.
It's interpretive, not mechanical,
exactly.
Is how you put it. Yeah.
Exactly.
And it seems like such a delicate process. I mean, if you tinker too much, you say, you kind of could neutralize the intent. But there is a reason for you being there. I mean, you do have to identify the problem. So I guess it's striking the right balance, I suppose.
Exactly. It's having the judgment to know, you know, how much to try to change, when to draw the line. And writers may be wonderful writers, and they still might have funny quirks, funny things that they do that, you know, there are writers who are not good spellers. Mm-hmm. There are writers who are just a little bit careless about matters of grammatical number, say. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when the verb has to suit the noun. They both have to be plural or they both have to be singular, and the right. Same with pronouns. Who and whom mm-hmm. are very difficult. Even some of the best writers, you know, they don't necessarily have the mechanics of the grammar. And we'll just say, this seems like it should be whom. And once, if somebody comes along behind them and analyzes it and sees that it should be who, then you save somebody an embarrassment. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. You tell the story about finding this, really, it was a small thing, a small inconsistency in a piece written by Philip Roth, and he was eternally grateful to you.
Well, it seemed he was very nice about it. He did write me this nice note. It was when his novel, A Few Chapters from I Married a Communist, ran in the magazine.
Yeah.
And there was not very much to do at all with on them, but he did send a note. He did not send a note. The editor wrote on the proof, Philip Roth says of Mary Norris, "Who is this woman, and will she come live with me?"
Right.
And that was, very nice comment. And I gather that that meant he thought that he appreciated my attention to detail. Probably he thought I would make a terrific housekeeper.
Yeah. But you do say, though, that the really great writers, most of them anyway, I guess, enjoy the editorial process. They like it when people are going through their work. I guess they don't want it to be, neutralized, of course, but they like the process, I guess.
Well, they're not defensive about their work.
Yeah, yeah.
And if there is something that's off, they want to know. They want to know what the effect of the words are. And I think, writing is lonely. So to have a lot of people paying attention to you, to your writing and weighing all your sentences and, kind of knocking on the words, making sure there's no hollow spots. That's that kind of attention I think writers are grateful for.
Mary Norris is with us. Her book is called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. Need to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Mary Norris. She's a page OKer for The New Yorker magazine. It's like a copy editor, though it's more than that, certainly more than just searching out typos or misspellings. Her job is also about context and style. And her new book is, at least I think anyway, part memoir, part about her life at the magazine with such a high standard and distinctive sensibility, The New Yorker magazine. Her book is called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. She's joining us from a studio in New York City. You started with The New Yorker in the editorial library. That was your first connection to it, and then sort of worked your way through. And you write about your first big catch, catching a – I don't know if typo is the right way of putting it, but catching a mistake. I mean, would you talk about that experience? Because that seemed like kind of an important moment for you.
Yes, I was in the editorial library where we took the magazine apart, slicing up the columns with a razor blade and pasting them into big scrapbooks for writers. And I was glad to have any job at The New Yorker, but I wanted to help put it together. So they had a little training program for people to learn some of the jobs in editorial, and one of them was called Foundry Proofreading. And that is a job that comes way at the end of the editorial process after the editors, the authors, the fact checkers, the okayers, and proofreaders are finished. They have a paper trail and called the reader's proof. And what the foundry reader does is read the new version against the old version and make sure no mistakes have been introduced in the changes. The okayer is doing the same thing, but the foundry reader does it in a mechanical way. So you're really only supposed to make sure the lines haven't been dropped and that any words that should have hyphens at the end of the line, if they're divided, that those are in the right place, that the words are divided right. But I would always read the whole line anyway as quickly as I could. And this was in a piece on Christmas. It was a Christmas list on food. The New Yorker used to run very long lists of shopping ideas back in the early 80s, or well, way back before then. And my eye just lit on this. It was about shopping for staples. I mean, that is pantry items, yeah, in the basement of Bloomingdale's. And the writer had put something about sacks of flour, and it was spelled F-L-O-W-E-R. So, of course, I thought, and she must mean flour, F-L-O-U-R. And so I made that correction at this. When you're a foundry reader, you don't make changes. You just flag things for the okayer and the editor. So, you know, I drew it out to the margin and wrote F-L-O-U-R and put a question mark. And it, of course, it was supposed to be F-L-O-U-R. And that mistake had been in, as far as anyone knew, it had been in the manuscript. And it had come all the way through, almost to publication. And that's what the foundry level of proofreading is for. It's a safety net. So I had made this catch. And then when I made the catch, I couldn't go around the halls, you know, shouting, Yahoo, I made a catch. I just had to go back to my job with the razor blade down in the library. The magazine at that time was across the street from the Algonquin Hotel, and I treated myself to celebrate. I went over to the Algonquin, the little blue bar, and I had a beer and peanuts for lunch that day. And a little later in the week, I got a note in the library from somebody on the 19th floor, and it said, we thank you, I thank you, the proofreader thanks you, the fact checker thanks you, the author thanks you. We all thank you for doing what we in all our numbers could not do, catching the flower, F-L-O-W-E-R, for flower, F-L-O-U-R, in the Christmas list on food. And it was signed with the initials G.B., which was Gardner Botsford, who was a wonderful man and a fabulous editor. And in fact, it was his wife who had written that column, Janet Malcolm. Mm. And you know, I didn't mention her because why would you mention someone just in order to say she once had a typo column? But I do acknowledge her at the end.
Yeah. So many great characters from The New Yorker in the book. When you work your way into the collating department, this is when you first encounter Eleanor Gould. I wanted you to talk about her. She's sort of a legendary figure in The New Yorker.
Yes, she read everything in the magazine in galleys, which means that when the manuscript comes in, it gets a very cursory copy editing where the copy editor just fixes misspellings and styles things for New Yorker spelling. But then Eleanor would read everything, not the fiction, but everything else, and she would apply her rigorous logic to it. And she really did a lot. We used to study her proofs, and I first saw them, as you say, when I was in collating, because I had to transfer the changes from Eleanor's proof onto a clean proof for the printer. And that was a workout, believe me. Mm-hmm. It was easy to miss things. The editors were easily overwhelmed by Eleanor's queries and would just put a straight line down each side of the page saying, take it all.
Right.
Certainly William Shawn did that because he trusted her completely. So she would sometimes do things that I could not fathom for the life of me. And she would also write really amazing notes in the margins. Somebody had written another Christmas list for gifts for children. It was about toys. And the writer had written that, you know, that old saw that every Raggedy Ann doll mm-hmm. has I love you written on her heart. And I guess you can feel that the Raggedy Ann doll has a little wooden heart in there. But Eleanor objected to that, said it does not. And she knew because as a child, she had performed open-heart surgery on her rag doll and knew for a fact that there was nothing written on his little wooden heart. So that was the sort of thing you would sometimes see on a proof of Eleanor's.
Were you afraid of her from time to time? Was she a scary figure in some way?
She was intimidating.
Yeah.
If you know, of course, the only way to learn and to banish your ignorance is to go and ask questions.
Yeah.
So, you know, I went and asked her once about a hyphen. I was always trying to figure out the rules for hyphens. It turns out it's not a mystery, but in those days it was. Eleanor had hyphenated the term blue stained glass. She put a hyphen between blue and stained. And I guess I disagreed, but who was I to disagree? So I went to her to find out why that needed a hyphen. And she made me feel very small. You know, I didn't understand why it needed a hyphen, and she explained that it was not explicable. That I guess I just should shut up and put that hyphen in.
But what did that tell you? Because you have a whole section about hyphens. And this is the thing that surprised me a little bit, just the kind of subjective nature of being a copy editor.
Well, there is a lot to weigh and to think over. And even though there are rules, you know, according to Eleanor's logic, blue stained should have a hyphen. Stained is a participle, and blue modifies the participle. But according to my logic, stained glass was a thing, and it was blue. According to Eleanor's logic, glass was a thing that was blue stained. And, you know, we were both right. And in those cases, yeah, generally, whoever feels more strongly is the one who wins. They're the one, you know. So, and of course, Eleanor was far above me intellectually and in every other way. So I was just trying to figure things out. But, you know, there are other, and the hyphen is really interesting because even if you apply your best logic to it, flawless logic to it, mm-hmm, usage may have already determined a different way to do it.
Yeah.
And usage is what wins.
Yeah. That seems to be a takeaway from the, I have to say, from the book, because you mentioned the idea of usage throughout. And the, you know, whether you're a descriptionist, and the counter to that is, what is it, prescriptionist?
Prescriptivist.
Prescriptivist, yes. Yeah, I knew I'd mm-hmm gotten that wrong. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because this requires some context and imagination.
Well, those two words, I think, started getting bandied about back in the 60s when Webster's put out its third edition of the Unabridged International Dictionary of the American Language. And it meant that, prescriptivists, they prescribe how to use the language correctly. Descriptivists just say how it is.
Yeah.
And that's what the Webster's third was doing. Webster's second, which is a beautiful, beautiful volume, would come right out and say, ain't is vulgar. And Webster's third might not give you that clue that if you, you know, that maybe you should think twice before using a certain word, because people will get an idea about where you came from and mm-hmm what your class is and what your level of education. So the prescriptivists now are the ones who are the grammar, well, I've been called a grammar Nazi. And it's not a term I'm crazy about, and I'm sorry to be giving it any currency at all.
Yeah.
But we are thought of as the ones who enforce the rules. And the descriptivists are the ones, well, I think that in linguistics, you know, their version of grammar is just to say how people do it, whereas the prescriptivists fall back on the rules.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess I am, I've been told that I'm a prescriptivist, and I am somebody who employs the rules. I think it's a good thing to have rules. But I'm enough of a descriptivist to admire a writer's voice and to let a rule slide in order to keep the integrity of what the writer has written.
There's this interesting section where you write about sort of the hierarchy of dictionaries at the New Yorker. Webster's, the three editions of Webster's are the ones you tend to use. And I thought it was interesting you don't at all use the OED, at least not much anyway, it seems.
Well, the OED is, of course, a fabulous resource, but it's not practical.
Yeah.
On a day-to-day level in a magazine office or for a newspaper, you know, you open the OED to find out the meaning of a word, and you find out all the ways it's been used since the first time it
right
appeared in print.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is. It's wonderful. I would love to have a full select, you know, the whole set of OEDs in my home or subscribe to it online, but I would never get any work done,
yeah,
if I started trying to look words up in it.
Yeah. You like you don't use dictionaries online much, you say, or at least you like the idea of just sort of turning a page, finding it in print, I guess.
Well, I think it's just that I'm old-fashioned, and that's what I'm used to,
yeah,
is looking words up in a paper dictionary. Also, though, you know, it does have its benefits. When you use a dictionary, you have the opportunity to browse around in there a little. You know, there's illustrations, there's words around it. And I think Webster's, Merriam-Webster has done a wonderful job with its online dictionary. And I use it more than I used to. It turns out it's, you know, well, of course, it's a wonderful thing. And it even has pronunciations. You press a button and you can hear how a word is pronounced. And that's very valuable. And the younger generation at the office just automatically uses the online dictionary. But what I love about the paper dictionary is that you can browse around in it. And you can't do that online. As I say, Merriam-Webster's does print on put on the page what word follows and what word precedes the word you're looking up. So they're trying to give you a sense of the context of the word in the dictionary, but it's nothing like having a whole double spread of words laid out in front of you.
Mm. You write a bit about Noah Webster. You have a kind of an affection for him, it seems. He was kind of this marketing genius. He was a descriptivist, Webster was.
He was, yes. It's funny because his big, the big dictionary that came out of Noah Webster, and he, of course, completed his own version, his own dictionary in his own lifetime, and then his heirs teamed up with the Merriam brothers, and they kept improving it and improving it. But it did kind of surprise me that to realize I visited Noah Webster's birthplace, and they had a little slideshow on him, and I bought a facsimile copy of his original spelling book for children, for school children. It was called The Blueback Speller.
Mm.
And he quotes, I think it's Horace, and I don't know Latin, but the point of the quotation was usage rules. You know, you can make up words and you can make up rules, but whatever the people are saying, that is what's going to happen in the language. That's where it's going. And that's what Noah Webster knew. He wanted to reform spelling, and he tried a few things, and when they didn't take, when the American public rejected them just spontaneously, you know, they didn't argue, they just continued to spell them the way they
right.
liked to spell them,
right.
he backed off. He realized, well, that's not going to work. The people have spoken, or the people have spelled.
Franklin wanted to reform the spelling, too. That was interesting.
Yeah, he had a very elaborate scheme. Well, Benjamin Franklin did so many things, but they were friends. Benjamin Franklin was much older, but he tried to influence Noah Webster to adopt his spelling rules. And Webster, of course, was delighted to be palling around with Ben Franklin and also George Washington. He was part of that generation that came of age during the American Revolution, and he was a patriot.
Mm.
And his whole idea of doing the dictionary was going to be his rebellion. That was going to be his contribution to the revolution, to make the English language have an American version that was as worthy as the British version.
Mary Norris is with us. Her new book is Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. When we get back from a break, we'll talk about the New Yorker's infamous use of commas. We'll probably talk about profanity when we get back, too, so stick around. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mary Norris. We're talking about her book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. Mary's one of the copy editors at the New Yorker magazine. She's joining us from a studio in New York City. Let's talk about Lou Burke, because that will get us into this conversation about commas. She seems intimidating, too. She was a proofreader, as you say, proud of it. Not everybody can read proof, is the first famous line that she mentioned. Talk a little bit about Lou Burke, because Lou Burke used to be the keeper of the comma shaker. You are now, but let's talk about Lou and the comma shaker.
Yes. Well, Lou was the opposite number of Eleanor, of Eleanor Gould. Lou Burke sat in the office right next to her. And I don't know how Eleanor felt about Lou. It was always hard to read Eleanor. But I know that Lou did not like Eleanor's work. Eleanor put in too many things that were her own personal preferences. I said before that Eleanor read everything in the magazine in galley except fiction. It was Lou who specialized in the fiction because Lou had the respect for the writer's voice that I don't know that Eleanor didn't have that, but Eleanor did ride roughshod over a lot of jokes, let's say.
Yeah.
And Lou was more careful with that. And one of the things that Lou thought was crazy was New Yorker style on commas. You know, she was paid to use New Yorker style to deploy those commas, and nobody could do it better. But she would also make fun of them, and that's why she had made from a little canister this thing. It was canister with a perforated lid,
yeah.
And she wrapped paper around it and drew with a pencil commas on it and the word commas, and that was her comment on the close style of punctuation that the New Yorker used, that, you know, we'd sprinkle in the commas. And if you can picture somebody sprinkling red pepper flakes on a slice of pizza, that's kind of how the comma shaker worked. So, yes, Lou was more lenient about letting writers use commas that I think of as ear commas, you know, the kind that are just there for stylistic reasons. And there's no, in fact, they're breaking a rule. Say, a comma between two elements of a compound predicate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, she put in commas and she took commas out. You don't need a comma after she put in commas. But some writer might like the sound of it. And a lot of writers put that comma into those kind of sentences all the time.
Yeah.
And you have to judge whether it's working, whether it has some, whether it gives some oomph to the sentence, or whether it's just, you know, whether you can pluck it out and not do any harm.
You've written about, there's this great piece you wrote about in response to the writer Ben Yagoda, who was criticizing The New Yorker for using too many commas. And it seems like you feel a little conflicted about it. I mean, you're the keeper of the comma shaker now, but you have a sense that commas are, how did you describe it in this piece you wrote? It was a Lee Atwater sentence, and I'm trying to remember exactly how you put it, but what you were saying was it wasn't necessarily about style, but it was about intent, that you had to keep coming back to the intent of the writer, I guess.
Yes, I think the sentence is something like, Lee Atwater died, comma, of brain poisoning or something like that, comma, in 1969, comma, before he could apologize to his mother. That's not the sentence. I'm sorry. I have the book in front of me. I ought to be able to read it. But the point of the sentence was that Lee Atwater died before he could make amends, before he could apologize. And those things about what he died of and when he died are subordinate to the meaning of the sentence. And that's why the New Yorker commas them off to make that point. And Ben Yagoda said another publication would not do that. They wouldn't use commas to create shades of meaning the way we do. And we don't intend for every one of those commas, you know, we don't intend for the reader to stop and take a breath or pause. Those commas can be read right over, but other commas cannot. Of course, other commas, we do expect people to take a breath for, at least the writer does. So it's just, there's a difference in philosophy.
Yeah. There's one question that comes from our website. Someone wants to know, do you fight being too judgmental, or do you think less of people that have bad grammar? You know what I mean? Do you fight that resistance to say, where were you brought up? Where did you get that grammar form?
Well, I like to think that I can go off duty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm hanging out with my friends in Rockaway, I start talking like that. I start saying, well, me and him are going down to the bar, you know. Yeah. And sometimes my friends in Rockaway are shocked, say, that sounds terrible coming out of you. But I, you know, I was brought up in a home where my father said, oh, it don't matter.
Yeah.
And when I look back at my old fifth grade diaries, that's how I spoke. I patterned myself after my parents. And education kind of drove it out of me for the most part. Certainly I can write without using that kind of grammar. But it's and it does tell you things about people. It does not do damage, though. You know, I mean, if I know, well, that person is from Queens,
Yeah. That's
not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, Queens is a great place.
Here's this from Ben, who writes, David Foster Wallace wrote in an essay about snoots, which was his family's nickname for the grammar Nazis, kind of people who for sport scrutinize publications like The New Yorker for grammar and usage mistakes. And he struggled with snootism. And here's the question from Ben. Do you consider yourself a snoot? That is, are your sensibilities always affronted when you read stuff in other publications? Not just the way other people speak, which is what Jim was after. Ben's, when you read other publications, are you copy editing, I guess?
I'm going to have to say yes. I think I'm a snoot in the sense that I notice. And especially if it's in a publication that is supposed to be well-edited and that is supposed to be setting an example, I do notice. I don't do anything about it, though. You know, I mean, Yeah. Well, I've been making these videos for The New Yorker, and I might use something as an example in a video. I would never use an example of a mistake from The New Yorker. That would not be politic, I don't think. I notice them, but I'm not the kind of Lynn Truss gorilla punctuationist. Yeah. You know, I don't carry a little sack of apostrophes around to paste where they should be or mark graffiti on things to fix things. I do notice, and I think that I am in the David Foster Wallace camp.
I loved the section on profanity. And we can't name the title on the radio, I'm afraid.
Okay.
Okay, be careful. But it's great. You say right up front, with some glee, that the casual use of profanity has reached this high tide. But I love how you write about how you're not – You write this, I'm not sure how much further we can take profanity and still enjoy it. So would you talk about this section, the use of profanity?
Well, it's gotten a lot more prevalent. And in The New Yorker, especially, I don't think we're cruder than a lot of other publications, but we're cruder than The New Yorker was in the early days. Yeah. That's
William
for sure.
Sean was he wouldn't allow it. For a
he
long
was
time.
Very puritanical, yeah. Yes. He would even take it out of quotations. And that's where we started having to put it in because, well, the thing that changed me was a piece about the rapper Earl Sweatshirt written by Kelliphas Sana, in which he quoted verbatim the tweets of these rappers and the hip-hop artists and I had to read them over and over again and make sure that all the four-letter words had their letters in the right order. And it just kind of ruined me so that I missed some actual typos in regular words like than and then.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, you know, you don't want to simply have it come to the obscenity being like a piece of punctuation or an intensifier like the word very, you know, which one of our favorite words is a substitute for.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the trick, is not to ruin it. It has to have a little bit of force I think it's funny. If I think it's funny, you know, then it passes. If it adds something. You know, sometimes when I'm writing myself, I will just throw an obscenity into a simple sentence like, I missed the bleeping bus. Right. And it just is more fun to write that way. And then later you can go back and take it out.
Yeah, it ought to be fun, is how you put it. I mean, you couldn't ever legislate it. No one wants, but you know, prohibition, you say, wouldn't work. But no one wants to be pummeled constantly by four-letter words.
Yeah, it's true, and I think the pendulum has swung almost as far as it can. Yeah. You know, until the tabloids start putting four-letter words right in their headlines. I think there's still a little room to go, but I think, you know, I imagine it'll start swinging back again. Everything, once it's allowed, people get a little carried away with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it'll get, I think there'll be more control over that after a while.
When you did finally make it to the copy desk at The New Yorker, you say it was a long time before you could once again read for pleasure. I guess you're reading for pleasure now, and you're able to just read and put aside the job for a while. Is it true?
Yes. It was a couple of years. I was, you know, I would have to, everything I saw, I would notice all the typos, and I would be tempted to get my pencil out and put them in my paperback version, and even tempted to start over and do a proof for the publisher and send the book back and demand that these typos be fixed. But I got over that. I started to see that as long as it doesn't interfere with the pleasure in the narrative, the reading, you know, I can just see, oh, well, that typographical error slipped through. Or I can notice a choice in punctuation and think, funny comma. But it doesn't interfere with my pleasure in what I'm reading if what I'm reading is something good. And I do try really hard to always read things that are well written and well edited.
Mary Norris, her book is Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, joined us from a studio in New York City. Mary, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.